My first day in college was at a Christian college in Ohio, Western Ohio, and we were sitting in the gymnasium, and on the wall was a huge round symbol of the college, and in the center of it was a crown, and around the crown it said, Pro Corona et Fidere Christi, and then around that, on the outer edge, it said, for the word of God and the testimony of Jesus Christ, which is not the translation of the Latin inscription in the middle. It's different. And the outer inscription is the one that was always quoted. This is at Cedarville College, now Cedarville University. It was a Calvinistic Baptist college. And come to find out, over time, I pondered that Pro Corona et Fidere Christi, and with the crown in the middle, it means for the crown and the covenant of Christ, but I didn't know what that meant. And as a history major, that's why I went there, because the history department and four-year basketball scholarship, I had to have both. I found out what the meaning of that interior section was for the crown and the covenant of Christ. For Cedarville College had been a covenanter college from when it was founded in the 1880s up until 1952. It had been a Reformed Presbyterian covenanter, a small covenanter denomination, albeit. It had been their college, and when the denomination to which it was associated, with which it was associated, joined the United Presbyterian Church, which was liberal, the college refused to go. And the professors there were still clinging to the Reformed faith and refused to abandon their heritage. And so they lost all their support from the mainline denomination. And the result was that they had to get rid of the college. And they chose a small Calvinistic Baptist group from Cleveland, Ohio. They were regular Baptists, as they're called. And at Cedarville College switched from being Reformed Presbyterian to being Baptist. And both of their mottos were combined into that seal. And in my own life, it actually combined two different traditions and heritages came together there, because I was raised as a Baptist. And the idea for the Word of God and the testimony of Jesus Christ was very familiar to me. But for the crown and the covenant of Christ, what does that mean? And over the years, I have studied and studied and studied where that came from. And I'm currently writing a biography of the first covenanter martyr in Scotland, James Guthrie, who is actually a kinsman of mine. And so it has come to have great meaning personally for me, the idea of Christ as the covenantal head of his church, and all that that implies for the Christian. A day hardly goes by in our lives we don't hear about the persecution of Christians somewhere in the world, where they're being denied, being denied jobs, being attacked, being murdered, executed, especially in Muslim countries, but in other places too, in India, among Hindus. Occasionally they go on a rampage and kill Christians in different parts of the world. And what would you do if the civil authorities came to you and said, you have to recognize Caesar as Lord, or we're going to take your children away, or we're going to close your church and you're not going to be allowed to worship anymore because you're rebels to the state? Well, that's essentially what happened in Scotland in the latter part of the 17th century. And to that event in history, I would like us to turn our attention. So I'm going to pick up where I left off in the last lecture and bring you up to the creation of the signing of the National Covenant and the Solemn League and Covenant, and what happened, who the covenanters were. It's often been called by historians the Second Reformation in Scotland, and it came the century after. And I'll give you some dates here, too, to try and fix this in your mind. Keep in mind, Martin Luther was 1517 until the 1540s, And then John Calvin was 1540s to 1560s. And then John Knox, 1660s, 1670s. And then in the, after the death of Knox, the Church of Scotland actually looked to one of their greatest preachers and scholars to give guidance to the church, a man who was a very, very powerful character. His name was Andrew Melville. And Andrew Melville replaced John Knox. And it's really Melville who worked out all the implications of Reformed thinking for the Church of Scotland. He's really the one responsible for the creation of the Church of Scotland, more, in some ways, more so than John Knox. He took all the principles that have been established, and then in the next generation, he's the one who helped Scotland to work through that. And so Andrew Melville comes into the picture. Andrew Melville was a man who had close ties with some of the nobility of Scotland that was reformed. And we actually left Mary Queen of Scots with her kind of her head in her lap at the end of her life. But she had a son whose name was Jimmy, although I'm sure they didn't call him that, James the Sixth of Scotland. And he had a regent who had to govern the country while he was growing up until he could take the reins of authority in Scotland and become James the Sixth. And he was trained, his personal tutor was one of the foremost European scholars in the whole world, a man by the name of James Buchanan. And he rejected, in the end, James the Sixth is going to reject a lot of the training that he got from this great scholar, although the scholar had not, I mean, he didn't suffer fools gladly, and James the Sixth tended to be somewhat of a fool at times. And was very strict with him. But eventually James the Sixth became the King of Scotland. And one of the first things he tried to do was choose bishops to rule over the church. And so back they went into controversy and problems in the Church of Scotland as the new king tried to impose his will on the Kirk. Once again, and remember, he was just a young man, and the church became reformed while he was young. With no church hierarchy in the Presbyterian form of church government, of course, bishops and archbishops that really had no place. They were abolished at the Reformation, and in 1584, under the order of and with the agreement of King James the Sixth, Parliament passed what were termed the Black Acts, A-C-T-S, the Black Acts, which affirmed the king's authority over the church, and it also restored bishops and placed ministers under the control of bishops. And so James the Sixth reinstituted an episcopal form of church government in Scotland, and the king himself was under the influence of Archbishop Patrick Adamson and James Stuart, Earl of Arran. The Earl of Arran often was a very powerful man. And the Black Acts tried to force Presbyterian Scotland to become Episcopalian again. Now, James the Sixth is shortly after this to become the King of England, and he becomes James the First of England. And he's very famously said, "No bishops, no king." Because for him, adopting the idea that the king was the vice-regent of God on earth and the head of the church, that the only way he could control the church would be through bishops and archbishops who depended on their living and depended on their incomes from the king himself. And so that's how kings controlled the church, was through the bishops. And King James the Sixth attempted to do that himself. Well, the Black Acts were abolished on June the 5th, 1592, when the Golden Act was ratified by Parliament. This also under James the Sixth, which abolished the previous rules and regulations that he tried to impose on the church. James was forced to sign it against his will. The nobles pressed it on him, just like the nobles had done on King John in England many years before. The Magna Carta was the same thing with young James. He was unable to resist Parliament, and they forced him into signing the Golden Act, restoring, getting rid of the bishops and the archbishops. But they would be back. For in 1603 came the unification of the monarchies of Scotland and England. There are two great political events in the history of Scotland in modern times, since the Middle Ages. And one was the unification of the unifications of the monarchy, where James VI of Scotland became James I of England. After Elizabeth died, he was the next in line. And so he became James I of England, James VI of Scotland at the same time. So that united the crowns of Scotland and England. And then 100 years later, the parliaments are going to be united under Queen Anne in the 1700s. But the uniting of the crown occurred in 1603. So James I, James Stuart of Scotland, became the King of England. He never returned to Scotland once he became the King of England. And the first thing he did was create bishops and archbishops to rule over the Church of Scotland, as well as England. He put his foot down on the necks of the Puritans in England. And in fact, he told the Puritans that they would conform, they would be conformists and become good Anglicans and recognize him as the head of the church, or he would harry them out of the land. And he did harry them out of the land. He harried them right to the New World. And, of course, in 1620, while he was king, the Pilgrims came to Plymouth. In the 1630s, when his son, Charles I, was king, he harried the Puritans out of the land, too, and they came to New England and established the Massachusetts Bay Colony as a reformed Puritan colony based on the Word of God. So these Stuart kings, these Scottish Stuart kings, began the big crackdown because they believed in the divine right of kings. That is, the word of the king is the law of the land. And the king is not subordinate to anyone but God. And in practical terms, that made the king God himself, because he was the one who mediated between the people and God. In 1618, James persuaded the General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church in Scotland. And, by the way, the organization of the church was, you know, at the parish level, I mentioned this earlier, was the congregation who elected elders and pastors, became the spiritual oversight, had spiritual oversight, the individual congregations. And then the local pastors, the local elders, would assemble in a geographical area, and that was called the presbytery. And the elders would get together to handle various issues and doctrines that came up, problems that came up in their particular group. And then once a year, they would have a general assembly where all the elders in the kingdom were eligible to attend a mass meeting once a year to deal with whatever issues had come up in the church, whether doctrinal or behavioral or whatever it was. And so a general assembly was... the King of England determined that the general assemblies can only be called when the king calls them. That the king was going to now control, through his bishops and archbishops, the general assemblies of the Kirk of Scotland. And at the general assembly that he called in 1618 in Perth, five articles were set down by the crown, by the King of England, for the Church of Scotland. And these were some of the things. They established the official dates within the Christian calendar. They allowed private administration of baptism and communion, dictated the communicants should kneel at communion, and agreed on a rite of confirmation by bishops. And all of those were seen as Roman Catholic innovations being brought back into the church. So the five articles of Perth were considered anathema by the conservative members of the Church of Scotland. and they were opposed by many. And in most churches in Scotland, from the Reformation until the Second Reformation, most churches went about their ministry as if the government didn't exist. And they just ignored things that dictates that were sent down from above, from bishops and such. Many churches just ignored them and continued doing their worship and their conducting their church business as they always had. But in 1637, everything suddenly changed. Not only did James the First, not only had he determined that he was the head of the church and gave a hard time to the Puritans and to the Scots, when he died, his son Charles the First took over, and he was doubly strong in his belief regarding the divine right of kings and the fact that he could dictate through his bishops how people ought to worship God. This is basically the state telling the church what they can and cannot do, and how God should be worshipped according to what the monarch says, according to what the state says. Now, Scotland had a long tradition of what we call separation of church and state. In fact, they're the ones who said that God has given the church certain jurisdiction over which the state has absolutely no authority. And the state's been given certain jurisdiction in their sphere of influence over which the church doesn't have authority. But they're to work together and cooperate in promoting a godly nation and a godly people, but they have their own spheres and they're separate and they don't have interconnection. And what the king was saying is that's not going to be the case anymore in England or Scotland, that we are going to be intimately involved in what the church says, what the church preaches, how the church conducts worship. And if you don't agree with it, and it's against the law, you're going to be fined or you're going to be imprisoned. And so that's the way things stood with Charles the First, who the son of James the First, who had become king in the 1620s. And right away, he put his foot down to control the church and said the state is going to determine what the church can preach and how they can worship. And, of course, there was great resistance to this among the Puritans and in England and among the Scots in Scotland. One of the ways the king determined to impose his will was a new liturgy for the church. Replace the one that John Knox had instituted and replace it with a new one. And in order to do this, he had first chosen as Archbishop of Canterbury, which is the highest ranking churchman below the king. See, Archbishop of Canterbury. And he chose William Laud, L-A-U-D, a very fortunate name, I would think, for a cleric, in Latin meaning praise. But William Laud was given the archbishopric of Canterbury, and he drew up a brand new liturgy. And it's called the Book of Common Prayer. And you're all probably familiar with, or some of you anyway, are familiar with the Anglican Book of Common Prayer. It's a book that has a bunch of prayers in it and a bunch of other sermons and collects and different aspects of the Anglican liturgy that are used each week in a Church of England, an Episcopal church in America. This is what they do. This is their liturgy. They've memorized it. And the preacher gets up and goes through the prescribed liturgy. Well, in Scotland, they didn't believe in that kind of a liturgy. They believed that you should only do what God has commanded in the Word of God. And it includes the preaching of the Word and singing and taking a collection and various aspects of what that means to worship God aright. But it does not include reading prayers from a liturgy book or following a liturgical calendar or any of those kinds of things. They also added other things in the course of time, a book of games, games that you could do on Sunday, and yeah, different things like that. See how far they could push the Scottish Kirk. So the first Sunday was set to use the Laudian liturgy in the Presbyterian Church, the Anglican liturgy, and they determined to do it at St. Giles in Edinburgh. And so the dean of the cathedral got up and he began reading the Laudian liturgy, which most preachers in Scotland and people as well believed was the first step in a return to a Roman Catholic liturgy. And as soon as he began to read the liturgy, and he was surrounded with his altar boys and the candles and all the stuff that the Scots hated, out there in the congregation, which is all, of course, they're standing, except for the old people would oftentimes bring in a three-legged milking stool to sit on. I certainly would have. And as soon as he started, as soon as the dean of the chapter started reading the new liturgy, a woman who lived in Edinburgh, they said she was a fishmonger, who knows what she said, some business in the streets of Edinburgh, was sitting there on her stool, and she stood up, she took her stool, and she flung it at the head of the dean and said, "What? You'll say mass? You'll not say mass in my lug." In other words, in my ear. "You're not going to say mass in my ear," and hurled the stool at him. And chaos broke out. The place went crazy. The Scots stormed the front of the church. The dean picked up his skirts and fled out the back of the church, followed by his entourage, thinking they were going to be mugged by their congregation. And that set off a rebellion all across Scotland to the Laudian liturgy. And the pastors of Scotland got together and they called for a general assembly, which was illegal because only the king can call a general assembly. And they, in the meantime, while the men were coming to the general assembly, several of the prominent men, churchmen of Scotland, particularly Alexander Henderson and Johnston of Warriston, Archibald Johnston of Warriston, who was a minor nobility, they composed a new national covenant for Scotland. Now, Scotland had adopted one in the previous century during the Reformation, and that had eventually fallen into disuse, and so they decided that Scotland needed a new national covenant, affirming their loyalty to the king in his civil realm, but declaring that Christ is the head of the church, not the civil government, not the king of England, not any kings, that Christ is the head of the church and his word will govern the church and how they worship and how they act and what they preach and all the things related to the church as the church. So these men drew up this, what's called the National Covenant. And it was really, it was a covenant, it was covenanting with God and with each other to only worship God as he has ordained, and the fact that they were a Christian nation and it was going to be maintained as a Christian nation, come what may. And so they called the General Assembly, and the king sent a noble, a Scottish noble, to protest, an archbishop, I think. Well, he was just a representative of the king. Sent him to protest and to shut down the General Assembly. And the representative of the king asked for the floor. The moderator of the General Assembly said, "You may say what you want to say." He got up and said, "This is an illegal assembly. You all have to disperse and go home. The king can only call a General Assembly and demands that you you leave." And the moderator of the assembly, who was still in the pulpit, said, "Thank you very much, representative from the king. Now, who wants to excommunicate all the bishops?" And that's what they did. They ignored the king and the king's counselor, and they excommunicated all the bishops of Scotland, who were men of who were not men of probity and godliness. They were the opposite. They were political appointees. They lived dissolute lives. They had no business trying to lord it over the church. And so they excommunicated them. And then, in the course of events, they adopted the new national covenant. And the new the covenant was written out, and they carried it down to Greyfriars Church there. And by the way, the Greyfriars are the Augustinians. They went down to the Greyfriars kirkyard, and they set out the in the church. They set out the National Covenant, and everybody came and signed it. And I mean, all the men and some of the women of Edinburgh, nobles, truck drivers, farmers, everybody came and signed the National Covenant. Page after page after page of signatures of people vowing that they would keep this National Covenant, which committed them to Scotland as a Christian nation, the Word of God as their constitution, and his rightful worship as the worship of all the people. And they signed it by the thousands. And then they carried it around Scotland to all the other cities, and people came in and signed and signed. And the only place where they had any trouble was in Aberdeen, where one of the universities was. The Aberdeen Dons, the scholars who ran the university, the professors, they ordered all the students to stand down and do not sign this document. It's a violation of what the king says. It's treasonous, etc. And so all the students promptly went right out and signed it. And none of the doctors, none of the Aberdeen doctors signed it. But all the students did, and all the other people around Aberdeen. So it traveled around the country, and some people pricked their fingers and signed it in their blood. I mean, they were serious Christians about their nation being a Christian nation, as plain and simple, and that their lives were devoted to his service and obedience. It's a remarkable thing in history, a national covenant being signed like that. Well, the response of the King of England was to declare war on Scotland. And wars are very expensive things. Everybody who signed that national covenant became known as covenanters. And over the years, over the next 20 years, a lot of people are going to regret their signatures. They're going to disavow them publicly and privately. But those who don't, those who refuse to disavow the covenant and disavow their signing of it, they're the ones who eventually, they're the ones who are going to be called the covenanters. Because they're going to be willing to die for the cause of Christ as they have signed their lives to. And die they're going to when it comes right down to it. So this is in 1640. So what else is happening in the world, of course? Puritan New England is thriving in America during this period. The Huguenots in France have been persecuted, and they're leaving. They're still fleeing France. There are a lot of other things going on in the world, but this huge revival of biblical faith is taking place in Scotland, and a second Reformation. Many people were converted during this time. The preaching was unprecedented, and they signed the National Covenant. So, King of England wants to go to war. Wars are expensive. The only way a king of England can go to war is for Parliament to give him money. Parliament's composed of the nobles of the land and the bishops and others, but nobility and gentry of England. So the Parliament serves at the king's wishes. And King Charles I had gotten rid of Parliament in the early 1630s. He said, I'm going to govern without Parliament. I don't need them. Because they were Puritans, and he wanted to take the country in a different direction, so he eliminated Parliament. Well, now he needed money, so he called Parliament into session. It's known as the Short Parliament. He called them into session and said, I want you to give me money to go to war with Scotland. And they said, not only are we not going to give you money to fight our fellow brothers in Scotland, but we have a list of demands that you are going to do. And so he suspended Parliament. That's why it's called the Short Parliament. He said, you're done. And they went home. So he gathered the royalists that he could gather that supported him, the nobles and their retainers. We're still, you know, we're no longer in the Middle Ages, but the nobility still has a lot of force to bring their tenants and their former serfs and their relations that kind of have old feudal ties, to bring them together to support the king in a war. So he raises an army, and he marches on Scotland, and he gets to Berwick-on-Tweed, and he looks out, and there's 50,000 Scots ready to fight. He's got 10,000 men, decides time to negotiate, tells the Scots, you know, no blood, no foul, and we're going home. That's fine with us, laddie. Go home. And off the king went and called Parliament back into session. Now he's furious. Charles I is a very arrogant guy, and he calls Parliament into session. And he says, we have to fight this war with the Scots. By the way, that was called the First Bishop's War, when the bishops called the troops together and went to Scotland, and they didn't fight. They turned around and left. So that was the First Bishop's War. But now he calls Parliament into session, and they become the Long Parliament, and they're gonna stand for years, because the result of the Long Parliament is civil war in England. The king eventually is going to declare war on Parliament. And so the English Civil Wars break out in the 1640s. So 1644 to 1650 or so, there's civil wars, one after another, in England. And Parliament invites Scotland to join them in fighting the king, and they do. Even though it is a Scottish king, it's Charles I, he's a Stuart, but the Scots believe that, the Covenanters believe, the king needs to be reined in. But the canny Scots told Parliament, if we join you in this war against the crown, you have to make an agreement with us. And that agreement is known as the Solemn League and Covenant. And what it is Parliament signed the Solemn League and Covenant, which said that they will continue the Church of England reforming, and that it will become Presbyterian, and that the people of England will covenant together to be a Christian nation in the same way that Scotland did. And Parliament signed it so they could get the Scots military abilities, which were considerable, on their side. And that's what happened. Now, Parliament never instituted the Solemn League and Covenant, and they, in fact, abrogated it, and Oliver Cromwell tore it up and said, this is irrelevant, and I would never sign on to something like that. Eventually, the king, of course, is beheaded. He's put on trial. He's captured by the Scots. The Scots turn him over to Parliament, thinking that now they can negotiate with him and they can work out some sort of amicable relationship here now that we have the Solemn League and Covenant. But the king is adamant that he's the absolute monarch and that he's God's representative on earth and that he's going to do whatever he wants to in the church. And he's just totally unrepentant of any of his views. And he had brought in troops, Catholic armies from Ireland, and he was even appealing to France to send troops to put down Parliament. And Parliament said that's treason against the English people, the English nation. So the king was put on trial for treason, and he was convicted, and he was executed. The only English king that was ever executed, and it was Charles I. And he goes to his grave, and with the execution of the king comes the separation of Scotland and England. The Scots will have nothing to do with the new regime, which is led by the army, the English army. And eventually, through the English army, one of their generals rises to the top, named Oliver Cromwell. And he establishes the Commonwealth of England with him as the Lord Protector. They begged him to become king, and he refused. But he became the Lord Protector of England and established a republic, as it were. And Scotland distanced themselves from Cromwell's England, from the Commonwealth. And they went to war. Cromwell invaded Scotland. And a number of his generals resigned rather than fight fellow reformed Christians. Two armies of reformed believers facing each other in Scotland. So Cromwell invaded Scotland with his Puritan army and defeated the Scots at the Battle of Dunbar. This was in the early 1650s. But through the 1640s, through all that decade of the 1640s, the National Covenant was in force in Scotland. And it's going to continue in force really for 20 years, up until 1660. And the people that had signed it are known as Covenanters. But again, a lot of Scottish politics gets intertwined with church business and churchmen. And there are those who always want to compromise. There are always those within the pale of the church that are willing to give up principle for pragmatic solutions to difficult problems. And that happened in Scotland. And the church actually divided into different parties. And the hardcore Covenanters were the ones who were followers of Samuel Rutherford and Alexander Henderson and James Gillespie and James Guthrie, the man about whom I am writing, and others rose to the leadership of Scotland, the church leadership, and political leadership, some of the lords of Scotland that were reformed. In fact, a lot of the men of Parliament were church elders, because you had to be a Christian to serve in the government, and a lot of the men who actually conducted the civil magistracy of Scotland were church elders. So there was a lot of cross-pollination, because believers served in all manner of callings, including politics in Scotland. So the covenant, they never had it better than the 1640s. Oh, by the way, those are the years, too, of the calling of the Westminster Assembly by Parliament. And out of it, six Scottish commissioners attend the Westminster Assembly. They're invited, Henderson, Gillespie, Johnston of Warriston, and I'm forgetting somebody really important, but I can't remember. But the Scottish commissioners came down and contributed mightily to the composition and the writing of the Westminster Confession of Faith, the Westminster Standards, the whole thing, and the Directory of Worship. And once that is completed in the 1640s, the Scottish Kirk, the Covenanting Church, adopts the Westminster Confession as the Confession of Faith for all the churches of Scotland. And so they all sign on to that. And that did not happen in England. There were just too many people who wanted the king to be head of the church. There were too many Puritans who were still royalists. And they could never get enough of Parliament to actually adopt. Formally, they had no interest in adopting the Westminster Confession for the Anglican Church. So it never actually happened. They stuck with the 39 Articles. Well, anyway, the Covenanters then went about trying to maintain the sanctity of the National Covenant and the continued reformation of the Church in Scotland. The English Civil Wars, though, eventually spilled over, as I said, into Scotland, and the Church actually kind of split over Oliver Cromwell, even whether they should support, once he conquered them, whether they should support him now as the new government or not. But there were always royalists in Scotland, and one of the things that brought Cromwell to Scotland, was a number of the nobles got together with the son of Charles I, as the uninspired name of Charles II. He was in the Netherlands, and they approached him, and they said, if you'll come to Scotland, we'll crown you the new king of Scotland. So Charles II came to Scotland, and he was crowned at Scone, just like all the Scottish kings. And the hardcore Covenanters did not go along with it. The Hendersons, the Gillespies, Samuel Rutherford, the James Guthrie, they did not go along with the crowning of the king, because he was a debauched reprobate, a liar, and a fraud. And they all knew it. But he came and he swore to the covenant. He signed the National Covenant. And he swore that the Church of Scotland forever would be free of government intervention. And as king, he would allow them to be just as Presbyterian as they wanted, without any interference from him. But he later, as soon as he became King of England in the Restoration, 1660, first thing he did was tear up the National Covenant and say, this is foolishness, and I didn't really mean it. And his whole life was kind of lived that way. He was a playboy, king, wasn't like his father or his grandfather. That kingly line declined in its true spiritual interest, you might say, in its morality over time. So Charles II is crowned by the Scots, and that, of course, Cromwell comes up and defeats the king's army, then the Covenanter army, really, at the Battle of Dunbar, and it's right out of the playbook, too. I mean, it's right out of the history playbook for Scotland. Every war, every battle that's ever been fought in Scotland has Scots on both sides, always. In fact, sometimes they switch sides in the middle of the battle. They see which way things are going. They switch sides and start killing their own guys and then joining up with the opponents, depending on the situation. As that happens all the time in Scottish history. Scottish military history is a confusing thing sometimes in the old days. But the Scots army went to Edinburgh Castle, and Cromwell couldn't capture it. Cromwell could not take Edinburgh Castle. And his men were tired, they were hungry, they were freezing, they were tired of campaigning, and they decided to return to England. They were also outnumbered by the Scots who were inside Edinburgh Castle. So Cromwell said, okay, we'll come back another day. And he retreated out of Edinburgh and started heading back to England. And the Scots said, what? Will you not fight? And so they came down out of the castle and met him in an open field battle where he had the greatest army in Europe. I mean, Cromwell had the finest military force in Europe, bar none. But that's an open field combat. The Scots came down out of the castle and met them on the territory chosen by Cromwell, and he defeated them at the Battle of Dunbar. I mean, he really smashed them, and he took 2,000 Covenanter prisoners and sent them as slaves to the New World. I mean, off to prison they went. Some of our Scottish ancestors came here as slaves, actually. Some sent by Cromwell, others by Charles II, others by James II. They were always exiling Scots for all kinds of reasons. Anyway, eventually, as you know, Charles II had to die, which he did, but not before he cracked down. He came back to England in 1660, was crowned by Parliament as the King of England. They were tired of the Cromwells. They were tired of the chaos and the disruption. And Charles came in and became the King of England. And right away, a lot of Scots switched sides and became the King's men. And one of the first things he did was appoint Archbishop of Canterbury, who then said, we need bishops and archbishops in Scotland. We need to crack down on those rebels. And so that's what they did. And he selected, he put a man in charge of Scotland, in command, who was one of the most diabolical of the Scottish generals. A man who had been a Covenanter, had signed the National Covenant, and then had become a total traitor, and had gone and lived with the king over in the Netherlands in exile. So when he came back, he was put in command in Scotland. And he chose examples of men to be executed, so to teach the Covenanters a lesson, to teach them all to be subservient to the crown, and to follow what the government wanted them to do as far as the worship in their churches. And he picked a preacher who was my ancestor, James Guthrie, the little man who couldn't bow, as Cromwell called him, to be hanged and beheaded. He chose the Marquess of Argyll, who was the most powerful politician, and they put the crown on Charles II's head. He'd crowned Charles. He was to be executed because he was a Covenanter, and several other men, four or five, that they are. Johnson of Warriston, who wrote the National Covenant, Samuel Rutherford, one of the greatest of all the Covenanter preachers, a man whose the letters of Samuel Rutherford have never been out of print. Even people that aren't Reformed like to read Samuel Rutherford's letters because he carried on this great correspondence with all kinds of people all over England and Scotland in his letters. But he wrote a book called Lex Rex, which means the law is king. And it's really the Scottish view of civil authority. It's the Scottish Kirk's view of the church and civil government and God's law, and all of those related things. And what it said was, or what it argued, was that the king is subservient to the law of God. The king is under the law of God. The law is king. And, of course, the English king said the king is law, just the opposite. And so Charles II had Lex Rex burned by the public hangman, and several books written by James Guthrie, and they had the bonfires, and they threw in every copy of everything that Guthrie had written and everything that Rutherford had written. And that was going to do away with the Covenanters. Sure. People that sign their name in blood to a document and haven't wavered in 25 years are not going to knuckle under overnight, and they really didn't. And so a systematic campaign was conducted by Charles II and his minions, his sycophants in Scotland, of breaking the will and the back of the Church of Scotland. And they did it in incremental steps. Finally, they started with actually putting out a declaration that had to be signed by every minister that the king was the head of the church and that they would obey whatever he said in terms of their worship and their church structure. And if you wouldn't sign it, then you were kicked out of, you're expelled from your pulpit. And in the Great Expulsion, 2,000 Puritan ministers in England were kicked out of their churches, and over 800 Scots Presbyterians were kicked out of their churches, pastors. They had no incomes. Most of them had little or no property. And they were not allowed in their churches, and it was illegal for them to preach. And then the king offered an amnesty to those who will come and sign this after all these problems. We won't make you do this, we won't make you do that, just as long as you read the prayer book. If you just read the prayer book, just a little bit we're asking, you can come back to your church and have your income again and have your home back for your family. And a lot of them had big families. And some did. Some compromised and they came back to the church. But a lot of them didn't. And they began holding services in the fields and in the barns and in their homes. And those were called conventicles. And Parliament and the king made conventicles illegal. And if you got caught at attending a conventicle, or you didn't show up at church, they took attendance. If you didn't show up, they made lists of people who didn't come to church. That is, the church approved by the government, by the state. If you didn't come to the state-approved church, they took notice, and you had to pay a fine. And then the second time you didn't show up, if you didn't have a good excuse, you would be incarcerated. And sometimes they'd be transported to Australia or wherever. So they persecuted anybody who attended these conventicles, these illegal meetings, as they were called. And thousands of people all over Scotland attended the conventicles. And even at the height of what's called the killing times, they were still drawing, in some meetings, 5,000 people out in the middle of nowhere, on the moors and in the forests of Scotland, all over the place. And as the 1660s progressed, so did the persecution. It wasn't long before any preacher who preached in a private meeting like that, what they called them private meetings, they weren't approved by the state. But if you preached in a conventicle and you got caught, you got the death penalty. And eventually it got to the point where if they caught them there, they had the right to kill everybody in the meeting, the whole church, kill the whole church. And this is the King of England. This is the Anglican Church. This is with the bishops and the archbishops. And this is how that's how they dealt with Scotland. They weren't quite as ruthless with the Puritans in England. And a lot of the Puritans, of course, the most radical ones, came to America and set up their own thing and just ignored all that. But in Scotland, they were hounded. And so then as time went on and it looked like the conventicles were not going to stop, they created special commando units to go out on Sundays and hunt them down while they were having worship services. And some of the Covenanters wouldn't stand for it. They were not there to have their families massacred just because they were being faithful to Christ. And so they began setting up picket lines around their services so that the troops could be spotted if they came galloping up the valley. And so the certain men, especially men with military experience, would set up command posts around to protect the congregations. And wouldn't you know, it resulted in a couple engagements. And the one great covenanter victory was at a place called Drum Clog, when the congregation was warned that the most ruthless of the and these are Scots killing Scots. These aren't Englishmen coming down on them. They're Scottish soldiers under the command of the Crown of England and under Scottish officers. And they, one of the most ruthless of the killers was coming towards Drum Clog. And the men carried their arms to church when they had their worship service. And so they formed in their ranks and they went out to meet the king's troops, and met them they did. They were attacked, and they killed a bunch of them. And a couple of the congregation got killed. And it was a small battle, but it was a great victory for the Covenanters. But then they knew now that this battle's been fought, blood's been shed, they've defended themselves, the king's coming with the big armies, and that's exactly what happened. And so the Covenanters rose in arms all across Scotland. And the greatest, two great battles were fought during the killing times, one at Bothwell Bridge and the other at what's called the Pentland Rising. The Pentland Rising was just a bunch of Covenanters. It was triggered by some soldiers in a town, small town in southern Scotland. Some soldiers were picking on an elderly man, an old white-haired, white-bearded gentleman, who was being kicked around in the street by a bunch of soldiers because he'd attended a conventicle. And a bunch of the young guys, you know, like the young guys here, they weren't going to stand around and see Grandpa get kicked around the street. And a couple soldiers got very seriously killed, and they captured the commander of this force. And they realized, you know, they'd done something that was really going to bring down penalties like no one had ever seen in the area. And so they decided to take a petition to Parliament in Edinburgh. And so all these young men got together and they headed for Edinburgh. And as they went, Covenanters came out of the woodwork everywhere and joined them until they had a couple thousand men marching to Edinburgh to present this petition. Well, that was seen as an uprising and an armed rebellion. And so the English called for the entire Scottish army and all the king's troops to gather together. And they fought this big pitched battle and called the Pentland Hills just outside of Edinburgh. And the Covenanters, I mean, they were carrying pitchforks and shovels. The king's armies showed up with their swords and rifles and artillery and everything. And so it didn't work out well for the Covenanters. A lot of them were captured and executed. They were tortured. And some of the tortures that the Scottish government had invented were really exquisite, right out of the Inquisition. But the Covenanters continued. They continued meeting on Sundays. They continued having, it was prohibited that any minister that wasn't ordained by a bishop wasn't a minister and couldn't have a baptism, couldn't conduct communion, couldn't conduct a wedding. So Covenanters that got married were considered, their children were all considered illegitimate because the government hadn't approved the ministers. And so one thing after another. And throughout the 1660s, 1670s, 1680s, from about 1672 to 1685 is called the Killing Times. And in the end, the Covenanters never gave up. Some did. Some went back and did whatever the government said, but most of them didn't. And they suffered for it. And there's lots of really great books about the Covenanters. And see if I can find the kind of the final tally. I'll tell you about Richard Cameron, and tell you about the final tally of what the Covenanters had suffered. One of the men, Richard. What did I just say? Richard Cameron and his brothers raised a small Covenanter force, and they rode into the town of Sanquhar, and they publicly issued what's called the Sankar Declaration. And in it they said the King of England is illegitimate. He has violated all the laws of God, and he has violated all the laws of Scotland, and we don't have to obey. Well, they then sent out all the hit squads to find Richard Cameron, and he fought them on a number of occasions with his troops. Eventually he was brought to bay, and he was killed in battle. But his men defended the conventicles. And once all of it was over with the glorious revolution and the coming of William and Mary and the ending of the Stuarts, and William and Mary come to the throne, although Mary is a Stuart, but the Prince of Orange comes as King of England, and all the rights and privileges are restored to Scotland. The Kirk is put back in place and still there. And all the sacrifices of the previous 30 years were not in vain, as it turned out in the end. But one of the things that the new English king did is he created an English regiment. Now that the Scots and the English were back on good terms, he created Scottish regiments to serve the crown. And they became the backbone of the British Army. And the first regiment that he created was called the Cameronians. And it was made up of relatives and followers of Richard Cameron, the great Covenanter defender. And the Cameronian regiment was one of the premier regiments of the British Army up until the middle of the 20th century. And when they enlisted, they were all Scots. And when they enlisted, they were given a Bible with their kit. And they were the only British regiment that was allowed to carry arms to worship services, which was their tradition. They would post men at all four corners of the church during their chapel services in the Cameronian regiment. And when they were stationed in India, the women of India were safe. And so were the businesses. These men didn't cuss. They didn't steal. And many of them tended to be very godly soldiers of the empire. It was the Cameronian regiment, going all the way back to Richard Cameron. I'd like to tell you more about them, but our time is up. The number of Covenanters who suffered for their adherence between the years 1661 and 1688 has been variously stated. According to John Howey and the Scots Worthies, the number who suffered imprisonment, banishment, or death was upwards of 18,000. Although this is regarded by some historians as on the high side. However, the figure was said to have broken down. 680 were killed in battle, 498 killed in isolated martyrdoms, just murdered. 362 were judicially executed, 750 were banished to the Northern Islands, 7,000 were sent into exile, and 1,700 were banished abroad. And there were actually even more than that. So these were people for whom the government said, you will do what we say. You will preach what we say you can preach. You'll worship the way the government says you're going to worship. And they refused to do it because Christ was the head of the church. For them, it was pro corona et fideri Christi. That was their battle cry of the Covenanters of Scotland for the crown and the covenant of Christ, for which they would not compromise. At least some of them would not. The core of them would not. And it's always over the years been something in the back of my mind that does the Church of America today have that covenanter spirit that they won't bow to Caesar. They will only do what Christ has commanded, and they'll preach the gospel without all the additions and the qualifications and the requirements that someone else might give other than Christ himself. Thanks. We'll stop there. And are there any questions? There are lots of great Covenanter stories that you should know about, especially the two Margarets. Who doesn't know about the two Margarets? Oh, everybody does, almost. Almost everybody knows about it. It was two young Scottish Covenanter girls who attended an illegal service, and they were staked out in the Solway Firth, which is an inlet from the sea. And the older Margaret was staked out further out, and Margaret Wilson was closer into shore. She was 18 years old. And as the tides came in, the first Margaret was drowned, and the soldiers were begging the young Margaret, the 18-year-old Margaret, to admit that the king is the head of the church and not Christ. And she wouldn't do it. And she drowned too. And their graves are right there in Wigton. It's one of the places we go on our tour. And their graves are in the kirkyard, and there's a monument out on the Solway Firth where they were staked out and drowned by the king's forces. There are lots of wonderful Covenanter stories, and I'm wearing my Covenanter tie. John Peyton is one of those stories. This is the Peyton tie. It's a drum and a Covenanter flag that is sold by his home church, which is still there. And the pastor of that church was Thomas Guthrie, who can't remember the title of the book he wrote, which is one of the great Christian classics. And I'll say this just in conclusion. In Guthrie's church, it's still there, is a big hourglass. And he was a very popular preacher in a small town. And when he mounted the pulpit, he'd turn the hourglass so that the congregation would know they weren't going to be shortchanged in the sermon. And I asked the current pastor, the church, of course, Liberal Church of Scotland today, I asked the current pastor there, I said, do you turn that over? And he said, oh no. He says, if I talk more than 10 minutes, they'd ride me out on a rail. And anyway, any questions?
So I'm raising a bunch of Scots, and it's not hard to imagine us in a similar situation. When I've wrestled for years with the when do we just submit to authority and when do we arm ourselves? I feel like most people in America would say if the government starts dragging us out of church and killing us, then we just say, well, we have to submit, either not meet or let them drag us out. But my Scots blood says,
not necessarily. I mean, that's the question that was debated, as you can imagine. That was debated by the Scots like you wouldn't believe. I mean, and they came to different conclusions. Good men came to different conclusions about where to draw the line. And I think the consensus was this, that when the civil authorities command you to violate a known law of God, if you know, if someone orders you to violate a known ethical command of Christ, you have to obey God rather than man. And that is what the apostles did. They were ordered to stop preaching. They said, I'm not going to do it. So God has called us to preach the gospel. That's our commission. That's our calling. That's what we're going to do. And the government said, no, you can't do it. Stop doing it. They said, no. And they suffered the consequences of that. The question for the Scots was, we know what the consequences are. We're not going to compromise when the government orders us to do something that's unbiblical. We know it's not the will of God, and they've ordered us to violate that principle. At what point do principles come in conflict, like the responsibility to defend my family? I mean, that was a big one, because a lot of Scots said, God has called me to be the leader of my home and to defend my family, and that is the covenant that we have, and it's biblical, and it trumps any covenant I might have with the government. And so I'm going to defend my family. And that a lot of Covenanters came to that conclusion, and that's the path that they followed, that they would defend themselves as long as they were, in their minds, at least fulfilling the commands of God. And when there's apparent contradictions in that, that's one of the things that the theologians wrangle about, you know, when there are apparent contradictions in what God commands and what has precedent. And if you read Lex Rex by Samuel Rutherford, you really get the gist of the idea of what legitimate government is. I mean, if government isn't legitimate, do you still obey it? And the apostles had to deal with that. Was the Roman government legitimate? Is Romans 13, you know, point blank? Whatever the government says, you got to do it because God put them there. Is that what that means? Why are they there? They're there to do what? To support good. To do good. To enforce the law of God. That's what government's created to do. So what happens when they violate the law of God and they're trying to force you to do it? Well, you can't do it. You have to resist. How far do you resist? Do you resist the blood or not? Well, that's the struggle that Christians have had to go through down through the ages. And many have said, no, kill me. Others have said, no, come and get it. Come and take it away from me. You know, like at the Alamo. It's a great question. I've got several programs and lectures on that whole issue. We don't have time for that. But that is the question that they had to wrestle with and that Christians down through the ages have. In Canada today, if a pastor is preaching in Canada from the pulpit and he's preaching on one of those passages from the Old Testament about homosexuality and he declares that it's a sin, and most pastors aren't going to go to the extent to say that it deserves a death penalty. I know some will do. But if you preach in the pulpit that homosexuality is a sin in Canada, that's against the law. And you can be arrested, and people have been arrested. It's against the law in almost every country in Europe. If they don't burn your church down, they'll at least arrest you. So there are certain things that are... If a pastor takes a vow to preach the whole counsel of God and does so in the face of prohibition, he needs to do it and face whatever the consequences are. That's what we're called to do, even though we might be persecuted or locked away or whatever. And those are the kinds of things that the covenanters who had taken this oath, and they knew what the legitimate government was, the lords of the congregation under whom they had taken their oaths. And they didn't consider, you know, they loved the king and they'd obey him. There were no more faithful soldiers for the King of England than the Scots down through this whole period, except when the government interfered with the church. So that's a huge question. And good men can disagree on that. But.
Thanks for sharing a very fascinating and wonderful period of history. So you have this guy, James I, who is an arrogant tyrant and a persecutor of Christians.
And a homosexual, yeah.
Okay, among other things.
King James Bible. Yeah.
And so how was it that it came to charter the Bible under King James, the beloved authorized version?
Yeah, he also fancied himself a theologian. And he certainly was quite an intelligent man. Not as much as he thought he was, but he was. I mean, he thought he was the smartest man in the world, he wasn't that. But he was intelligent, and he understood theology. And the problem he had was that all the Protestants in the United Kingdom were using the Geneva Bible. And the Geneva Bible, because it was really the first mass-produced Bible for English-speaking Christians, the publishers of the Geneva Bible realized that people were reading the Bible for the very first time and reading it in the vernacular. And there are a lot of words in English that they wouldn't understand. There are a lot of things in there that would have been unknowable by the average person. And so they put notes in the margin. This is the first Scofield Bible without dispensationalism. Dispensationalism. But they put notes in the margin so people could understand some of the terminology. And one of the Greek words that was translated tyrant, which is a good Greek word and it's used in the Bible, tyranny and tyrant, etc., they defined that in the margin. And when King James looked at the Geneva Bible, he saw those marginal notes and he said, that's treason, because the marginal note defined what a tyrant is. And he saw himself in that term. And there were other places in the Bible where the words were defined for the people so they could understand them. And the crown did not agree with those, the way it was defined. And They thought it was subversive, or King James thought that the Geneva Bible was subversive. And so he gathered the greatest scholars of the English-speaking world and some from Europe, and they used the same manuscripts that were used for Geneva Bible. And the text of the Geneva Bible, there's like 95% exactly the same as King James, so-called King James, authorized version. But the authorized version was put more in a poetic English fashion. It was easier to read, and it flowed, and it was beautiful, and embellished in different ways. And it became this, it really, because of the language of it and the way it was written during Shakespeare's time. A lot of the phrases that were translated from the Greek and the Hebrew into English were colorful and interesting. Not necessarily accurate every time, but they didn't necessarily get to the actual meaning, intent of the Greek or the Hebrew. Nonetheless, it was a beautiful translation of the Bible, and over time, it replaced the Geneva Bible in the English-speaking world because of the support of the English crown. And it was done on the behest of King James, and so when you read the interior first few pages of an old King James, I don't know if they still put them in there or not, but it says to our sovereign, our great sovereign Lord, King James the First and Sixth of Scotland, whatever, who authorized this translation. So that's how it came to be, and as a reaction against the Geneva Bible. The Geneva Bible is what the Pilgrims carried to Plymouth with them, and a lot of the Puritans stuck with the Geneva Bible because of it was really a Reformation Bible and with a strong Calvinistic flavor to it. But it had those notes in it, and that was what the king objected to. Because of how they handled issues that were too close to home for a monarch that was trying to subvert the church and lord over it. Anything else?